Hey, I'm here with Shai Davidai. I had to say that. It's Shauna Myers.
Well, you can say here I am. If you're
oh, sorry. Inclined,
my podcast is Here I Am with Shai Davidai, but yeah.
That's true. I took some liberties with the syntax there. Yeah. Okay. Take two. Here I am with Shai Davidai. This is Shauna Myerson with Yoga Athletica in Los Angeles, California. I'm deeply honored to have as my guest today Columbia University's Shai Davidai to discuss the issue of Jewish civil rights. Now, as a devoted yoga practitioner, I believe wholeheartedly in the dignity of all humans and equal and civil rights for all. In Sanskrit, we say loka, samasta, sukhino, bhavantu. May all beings everywhere be happy and free. In Hatikva, the hope, the Israeli national anthem, it cries out, liot. It's hard to think about when it's not a song. Liot amchoshi ve'artzino. To be a free nation in our land. There's only one tiny Jewish state in the entire world, a nation that has proven time and time again that it would literally do anything for peace. But peace is a two-way street, and Hamas has paved that street right into a dead end. The atrocities of 10/7 showed the world the depths to which evil can stoop, and astoundingly, much of the world has stooped to its level, celebrating terrorist barbarity and confoundingly turning on the Jews, the victims, in response. Nowhere has this moral depravity been more apparent than on our college campuses, and perhaps no campus more than Columbia University. No. If you were anywhere on social media in the days and weeks following 10/7, you saw the viral video of Shai Davidai's angry and brave, deeply moving, chilling, and desperate plea to the world to stand up against the violent, anti-Semitic, pro-terrorist students and faculty at Columbia University and across our nation's top universities. Shai Davidai is an assistant professor in the management division at Columbia Business School in New York City. His research examines people's everyday judgments of themselves, other people, and society as a whole, with a particular interest in the forces that shape and distort people's subjective perceptions of the world and their influence on judgments, preferences, and choices. It seems that that background has led him directly into this fight. Welcome, Shai, and thank you so much for joining me. You're an extraordinary inspiration, and your voice is honestly changing the world.
Thank you. Really, I mean, I have a very hard time accepting praise like this, A, because I think it's wrong, and I think it's overblown, but B, because I can only hope to live up to the praise. Like, I always tell people, like, I hope I could live up to the person you think I am. Can I say two things about your introduction, which was incredible?
As long as they're nice. No, just joking. Say whatever you want.
No. So just because I think it's also, you know, I can't help myself from being a professor, right? So one thing that a lot of people don't know about Hatikva, the hope, the Israeli national anthem, it was an anthem of sorts of the Jewish people way before it was Israeli national anthem. It was a song. It was a poem written by Naftali Herz Imbel. It's a very, very long poem. Two verses of that poem became that song that we know. And Jews used to sing it at the end of Zionist salons, at Zionist meetings. There are records, narrated records of people singing it on the way to the gas chambers in Auschwitz and Majdanek and Dachau. It's, you know, people think about it as like it's a national anthem. Why are you singing another country's national anthem? It's like, no, it's the Jewish nation anthem, which also then was adopted as Israel's national anthem. So I think that's important to kind of put out there. The other thing is, you know, when I started speaking out, you mentioned like pro-terror student organization, because that's the word that I started using, because that's what I was observing. I was observing student organizations that were supporting terror. I've stopped using that term, because what I've seen in the past months is not pro-terror, but para-terror organizations. I've started calling them para-terrorist organizations because while they are not terrorists, while they are yet not holding guns and are not using like outwardly explicit blatant violence, they are identifying themselves with the terrorists in the first person singular, our, we. They are amplifying the terrorists. They are hoping for the terrorists to succeed more. They are, just like we have on the extreme right, paramilitant groups. On the extreme left, we have para-terrorist group. So I think it's important that we call them as they are, which is para-terrorist student organizations.
Thank you for making that clarification, Professor.
You call me Sean, but I know I tend to be like professorial, you know. Like,
I'm so excited to find out this morning that we both went to Cornell, and which has also been like a poster child of anti-Semitism in this horrific rabbit hole that we are running down so quickly. So just to build upon just really quickly, like one sentence or two sentences about Hatikva and about what you were saying about that Hatikva was being sung prior to the establishment of the state of Israel, is that we call it a nation, and that even, so you're actually Israeli, though you're in New York. I'm actually American, though I'm in Los Angeles, and that's not a though, that's an and. But we are both a part of the same nation, not just because I love Israel. I've been to Israel about 30 times. I go all the time. I'm active in Israel, but because it doesn't matter. The Jewish soul is part of the nation of Israel. And so the nation really does transcend borders. And loosely defined religion, because I think different people have different ideas of what religion is via religiosity versus belonging to a family of nations.
Yeah, let me tell you, yes, and it's really, and I don't blame non-Jews for not understanding. It's not like, I don't blame them because it is peculiar. A person in the modern world who has been so indoctrinated to think that the individual is the most important thing has a hard time understanding the idea, the importance of community, but not community of neighbors and friends, but like being part of a tribe. And we are a relic. We are a relic of biblical times or ancient. It used to be the case, if you just look at history, it has nothing to do with religion. It used to be the case that there were tribes around the world, right? Mm-hmm. There were nomad tribes. Just like there are tribes right now in Africa, like the Maasai tribe, there were tribes in North America, the Native Americans and First Nations, there were tribes in Southeast Asia. Those tribes, as they became bigger and bigger and bigger, so some remained small, you know, like the Maasai remained relatively small and insular and very, very strong. Some became very big, right? They went from tribe to nation. That's why we call them First Nations in Canada, not First Tribes, right? The Jewish people, the Babylonian people, before they became an empire, were a nation. The Canaanites, they were all nations. What does that mean? They were all part of the same tribe. They shared history, they shared a language, they shared an identity, and they shared a geographical location. Most nations, when they were in exile, because they were so big and they could not sustain themselves as a nation, and then therefore they kind of lost their identity, right? Like we don't see many Babylonians walking around. The Jewish people, and we can talk about how and why, but through our traditions, some people would say it's religious. I have an historical perspective, but through our traditions, we're able to keep our nationhood as a diaspora. And we were able to do so and come back from exile to build the second temple, the second kingdom. Right? Back then, it sounds like crazy, the second kingdom, but back then it was all kingdoms, right? And then we were able to keep our diasporic nationhood for 2,000 years and come back again. But nothing really changed. So the idea of Israel for people where it's like, oh, it's a state, you support a state, you support a government. No, like we are called Bnei Israel, the sons, but the people of Israel.
Yeah.
Right? The gendered language is problematic, but it was 2,000 years ago. We're Bnei and Bnot Israel. We are the people of Israel. And what I'm trying to get people to understand is that you cannot treat our connection to Israel, and it's a spiritual connection, it's an emotional connection, it's an historical connection, for some it's a religious connection, you cannot take that and remove it from our identity. It's part of the Jewish identity, which makes Israel a Jewish civil right. And if you take a diaspora, and which is all centered around the idea of Israel, and you take down the idea, the center, what you're doing is you're breaking down the diaspora. And that's something that I cannot accept.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting to see the way that you're looking at things and expressing things and how they're bleeding into other people's conversations. So unfortunately, Shai, you do have to take more credit for what you're doing than you're willing to.
I don't know.
I was actually at a hostage rally here in Beverly Hills last night, and it was the first time I heard someone outside of you or someone discussing with you, someone used the word Jewish civil rights from the End Jewish Hatred organization. So you are making a huge impact, and I do want to get specific.
Wait, I want to be fair. No, I need to be fair.
Okay.
End Jewish Hatred, the organization End Jewish Hatred, which is the world's, right now, first and only, and I hope it won't be the only, but the first and only Jewish civil rights organization dedicated solely to Jewish civil rights has been around since 2018. I am in awe of them. I work a lot with them. So I'm not going to coin the term. It's not. I'm not going to take the credit. But okay. I am trying to push as many Jews to understand that when if you're afraid to walk around with Jewish symbols, and it doesn't have to be a yarmulke, it could be a Star of David, that's a civil rights issue. Right. I'm trying to get people to understand that it's not just out there. It's like it touches every part of your life.
Yes. And I do want to get really deep into that. But first, I want to start with context.
Yes.
It's amazing how words can be hijacked. Like the word context that out of a Jewish person's mouth just sounds evil anymore. And to an extent, even ceasefire or peace, like it's like, oh, you hate Jews too. And it's like, no, actually I'm pro-Israel and I want peace. And, you know, it's funny, even the word Palestine, like people have used it so much that people who should know better are using the word Palestine as if it's a state, and it's not. You can't have a state without a government or borders. But it's come so deeply into the discourse that the way people are using words is so haphazard anymore that the words themselves can dangerously create reality. So that being said, side note, context. Okay, so this infamous plague of anti-Semitism at Columbia has sort of become the stuff of legends at this point. I think it's going to be talked about for a long time. President Shafik, who I believe only started in like June or July, like some of these, I think Claudine Gay also had just started her tenure, in three deans at Columbia. Maybe there's more. That's what I know of. Have all stepped down due to their roles in this anti-Semitism crisis on campus.
Yeah, three deans. Because we're talking about the anti-Semitism texts that they were messaging, anti-Semitic texts they were messaging each other during an anti-Semitism panel. There were actually four people on that.
Right.
The most higher up dean, Joseph Soritz, who's the dean of Columbia College, has not stepped down. He actually started the year. He's in charge of hundreds of Jewish students. This anti-Semite, or at least someone who's very comfortable with anti-Semitism, is still at Columbia, still in charge of Jewish students. No consequences.
Well, I mean, same with Kornbluth at MIT, and I mean, I go down the list. What's his name at Northwestern? And
Concordia, McGill. Yeah.
So Well, I have like 100 pages of things that I want to talk to you about. Last week, Columbia had a scathing, more than 90-page report that came out, like talking about all the horrific anti-Semitism that has been happening on campus. And if I'm correct, I think it was part two.
It was part two, but here's also an interesting thing. This is how, when I went to Congress, I said versus the Columbias, right? I said versus the Columbia in theory and the Columbia in practice.
Exactly.
Right. In theory, Columbia cares about the Jewish students. In practice, it doesn't. And the report, they came out with a scathing report, the Anti-Semitism Task Force, really well done. But documents all of the instances, the horrible instances that Jewish students experienced for the past year. When does Columbia publish this report? A couple of hours before Shabbat.
Right, exactly.
On the Friday before Labor Day weekend. They put the report in the news. They knew what they were doing. They knew that if they release it, and you ask any PR person, if you release something on the Friday before Labor Day or Memorial Day, and if you do it, especially for the group is Jewish, you know, and before Shabbat, it will not be covered. Columbia did not want the world to see how horrible things are. This is the Columbia in practice.
Well, I mean, the UN does the same thing. The President of the United States does the same thing. The pre-Shabbat release of Jewish things is like a big thing in the world. And if nothing else, let it go through the news cycle for 2 days, which is 2 years in 10 years in 2024, you know, media cycle terms. And by the time, you know, the Jewish people have a chance to respond, you know, it's already indoctrinated across the globe 100 times over.
And I'll tell you even more, when we thought about when to release my podcast, because I have a weekly podcast, Here I Am with Shai Davidai, now my producers will be happy that I'm plugging it, go listen to it, Apple, Spotify, YouTube, whatever. But I decided, it was very important for me, but we release it every Friday. Every Shabbat, before Shabbat, you'll be able to download it and listen before or app, but it was like, if you're going to treat us this way, we're going to reclaim the narrative, and the Jewish people about the podcast about Jewish civil rights will be released every Shabbat. So,
table talk.
Yeah.
I used to actually go to friends who are Lubavitch to Chabad a lot for Shabbat. I was like family to them. We always had Torah talk. So it could have been our Torah talk, but it was too many years ago.
But that's the thing. My hope, I don't care if people see me. I don't care if people hear my name. I don't know my name or hear my message. But my hope is that people listen to the podcast, listen to the guests that I bring in, and that inspires conversations around Shabbat dinner. Maybe they, like a book club, they will have a Jewish civil rights club to like, here's the podcast and then discussing. Because I don't agree with every guest that I have.
Sure.
Of course not. We're Jewish. Of course I don't agree with every one of them. You know, but it's about having that conversation.
Sure. One episode that, because I've listened to all the episodes, but one that's really sticking out in my mind was, or one line of one. They're all great, but the one with Ari Ackerman where he says, you know, we fought so hard for this money and this influence. We don't fight for it to keep it. We fight for it to use it. And that was such a brilliant concept, right? And as people who are spending our, not just our money, but really our personal capital in this fight, that really, really resonated with me.
And not just the money. Like, we've fought so hard to get power and status.
Right.
Some people may not be in positions to give a lot of money, but they're in positions that they control the narrative. They, you know, and instead of hiding who they are, they should be like, no, we fought really hard, damn hard. Like, if I'm hiding myself now, I'll never come out. And I use the word come out. You know, can I tell you a story? I know you want to talk about a lot of things, but can I tell you a story?
Tell me a story.
I just got back from Montreal, and it was the most incredible visit that I had, because it's just an incredible Jewish community, and I was able to work with them to ignite something. And I feel like we're building something new and real. I gave a talk at the Shaar Shamayim congregation, and after the talk, there was this person, this guy who was waiting to talk with me. And he was waiting with his husband. And he told me, today was my first day of school. I was supposed to start my fashion studies. And I did not go because I was afraid.
Did he wear a yarmulke or anything?
No, okay. But he wears, you know, he's not going to hide who he is. And I told him, listen, I want you to promise me that tomorrow you'll go. And it doesn't have to be the entire day, just for a couple of hours. And I want you to promise me that you look for someplace in the university, a room where you can go and feel safe to cry and break down. And whenever you do, you run there. That's your place to be and recuperate. But then you go out to the world and you keep just showing up publicly, Jewish. That is your fight. Because you did not come out of one closet just to stay in another closet. And I really truly believe we all have different identities. And none of our identities should be hidden in any closet. Our gender, our race, our sexual orientation, our religiousness, anything, and our Jewishness. So, you know,
sure.
I was so touched by this story about someone who's like, he did not want to go to school. And he fought so hard to get into school. And I decided, we are all coming out.
It's interesting, and I think the parallel would more effectively be drawn 20 years ago before, like, the LGBTQ plus movement became so big and it became so accepted. Right now, the problem is that coming out as a Jew is different. And I have to say, like, so sorry, I know you don't want to accept this role, but I mean, like, again, like, even Ilan Levy called you the poster boy, like the poster boy of campus advocacy.
No, I don't want to be a poster boy. Poster boys are empty and vague and vapid, right? Poster boy is like, there's nothing there other than the face.
Okay, you're the three-dimensional hologram image of a poster boy. And what you said was that you would rather pay the price of speaking up than of staying silent. And I have to say, I many people have said, and people DM me all day, I'm the most vocal person who is sort of visible in the yoga community for Israel. And that includes my Israeli friends. And there have been some very, very big Israeli influencers in the yoga or the broader movement space who all but hide their identity, which makes me really sad and sometimes makes me a little angry. My sister made Aliyah in 2010. And so I talked to a lot of her friends and stuff, and in what they sort of say is, well, we're already doing our part by living in Israel.
Yeah.
It's your job to do the rest. And, you know, move here and you get to shut up.
First of all, you know, she's kind of right. You know, I don't know if I actually did the opposite of Aliyah in 2010 and I moved to the U.S. So I don't know if this would have been me if I was living in Israel. But, you know, I think part, and again, this is where I don't judge people,
yeah,
Jews or not. When they approach this and say, look, I'm a yoga teacher, I'm not going to involve my views about Israel in my practice.
Right.
And I don't judge, and it's completely fine. But that's because people see Israel as a view that they have. But if they really reflect, if they close their eyes and reflect, it's not a view, it's an identity.
Right.
It's not your, just like, you know, if you're in the LGBTQ community, your fighting for gay rights is not a view, it's who you are.
Right.
And me fighting for you is not a view, it's who I am as my values.
That's right.
Right. And I am not a woman, but I am a deep feminist because it's who I am. It's not a view. And I've always incorporated it in my teaching and everything.
Sure.
I am Jewish. Israel is part of my identity. It's not a view that I have. And that's why it's when people understand it, and I think you probably understand that, it doesn't become like a question. It's not of a, do I speak up? Do I incorporate it? It's more of how do I incorporate it?
That's right.
How do I do it in the most effective way that doesn't alienate people, but more important, doesn't alienate myself from who I am?
That's right. And that's very, it is who I am. And unfortunately, I think that in this post-religious society, and I don't want to make this about religion. I could already see that, no, it's not religion. But in this post-religious society, I just see particularly youth, but even I'll consider myself, I'm 53, I'll consider myself like youth, because when I go to pro-Israel things, I tend to be by about 30 years the youngest person there in general.
Well, that's not good. I tend to be the youngest person, the oldest person. So, you know,
Well, you're on a campus. It's a little different. When you go to APAC with the heavy hitters, you know, and it, anyway, but the only reason I'm considering myself in the younger generations in this context is that people are running so far, not just Jews, everyone but Muslims. You know, the Catholic Church is in a crisis. The Christian Church is in a crisis. The Jewish nation of people who, like, go on online dating. I mean, don't go on online dating because you're married. But, like, go on online dating. And every single person is, like, spiritual but not religious. And people are afraid to say, I'm Jewish, I'm Christian, I'm Catholic, I'm Muslim. And it's just, like, it's become this dirty word. So while I agree with you that we need to identify with Israel as what we are, unfortunately, I think there's this mad scramble to disassociate, not the least of which is this completely unfair conflation, there's all sorts of conflation of Jews with Israel, which is on one hand completely unfair, but on the other hand, very insidious in the way that it's making Jews run from Israel.
Yeah, I mean, and it kind of goes back to my point about nationhood, right? Because if you look at history, we were first hated for our religion. It was anti-Judaism. That was what it was about. Like, we practiced, and it was like, oh, if you only convert to Christianity, if you only convert to Islam, then we will no longer hate you. Many people did, right? The conversos in Spain. And then came later, you know, Queen Isabella, but saying like the one drop of blood, which is like, no, even if you converted, you'll be a second tier citizen, right? And then came the Nazis with race ideology, race theory, and now we were no longer persecuted for our beliefs. We were persecuted for our race. Like, even if you were a Jew that was then, you know, not Jewish, you're still Jewish. And now, when it's not in vogue anymore to persecute someone for their beliefs, and it's not in vogue anymore to persecute someone for their race, we are being persecuted as a nation. And that is why, like, when people say anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, and I say bullshit. It's, you have the same goal and the same means. You've only changed one word. Sure. The onus is on you to show that you're not. If you're going to claim that anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism, come stand next to me when I shout about shootings on private day schools, Jewish day schools in Montreal. If you don't speak up against that and you're speaking out against Israel, then you are not anti-Zionist, you're anti-Semitic, because you've taken this hatred and you went from religion to race and ethnicity to nationhood, but it's all the same.
Sure. And the fact that it's all based in double standards is what makes it so purely anti-Semitic to say that the Jews don't deserve a nation, but every other group does. Not to mention that what people don't seem to understand is that the UN, who maybe at one time was actually a legitimate organization, actually ratified it. I mean, they ratified this state of Israel. We didn't like go in with you know, flags and bayonets and conquer. We Israel is a internationally legally created country. So
yeah, but
say it's illegitimate, and no other nation is illegitimate. Where are all the other anti-blah blah-ists in the world? They don't exist.
Yeah, and to be fair, you know, the UN has done a lot of good in the world, but it has never been a legitimate organization. You know, 1974, well, actually, after
sure.
that, we had the UN resolution, Zionism is racism. That was the UN. In 1974, the UN invited Yasser Arafat, who came in military terrorist gear while he was a PLO terrorist with a gun in his holster, talking about the extinction of Israel at the UN General Assembly. The UN criticized the Israel and passed a resolution against the fact that we got Eichmann to trial from Argentina. The UN in the partition. In the partition plan, tried to renege on the partition plan.
Yeah.
You know, they tried to say, well, maybe not, maybe we'll do something else because the Arabs of the land refused to accept the partition plan. The UN has never been a legitimate organization. It's been an illegitimate organization that has done some good. And even a broken clock is right twice a day.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry if I'm a bit pissed, but you know, these are difficult
times.
Believe
me, I'm mispissed. So don't you can get as pissed as you want. I just tried my best to like maintain my yoga aura.
I love it. No, I love it. I wish I had that. I wish I had that.
Oh, believe me, I lose it. I lose it. But yeah, So just going back to this concept of standing up when it's scary to stand up, right? Like, so like my hashtag is principles over paychecks. You know, I have all but sacrificed my entire yoga business the last 11 months. And I will continue until all of our hostages are home. And
how's your business, by the way?
I can't really talk about that online. Let's just say that there's been a mass exodus. From my social media following, thousands and thousands, as there are every time there's a war, because I always speak up. This isn't a cause du jour for me. A lot of people have jumped into this thanks to social media, but I've been in this fight for at least 20 years, probably more before social media.
So, you know, I don't know if I actually have any sway in this world as people think that I have. But if anyone's listening, you know, I don't know you, Shana, but I would take a yoga class with you. So if anyone's in the LA area or online, like, follow Shana. You know, like, this is all about, like, I feel like I have lost a lot professionally, socially, but I've gained so much more since 100%. October. Speaking
100%.
Up.
And it's like, you become so entrenched in this cause that the cause becomes inextricable to who you are.
No.
And, you know, I didn't literally like, because I spend an inordinate amount of time preparing for these conversations because I'm very new into this, whatever podcast space, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
And yesterday I'm like going through and I'm writing up my things. This is what I'm going to talk to Shy about.
And then I show up and ruin everything. And you have all these questions planned and I go on rants because I'm a professor and an Israeli.
Oh, no, it's all good. But what I was going to say was like, oh, I have to do this one like yoga thing.
Okay, let's
and
do the
like,
yoga
I
thing.
Don't have time for that. I have to go to this rally at 6. You know, I got to get all this done.
Wait, what's the yoga thing? Let's do a yoga thing.
Oh, no. I mean, my yoga things are massive. Like, I don't have small yoga things. I have, like, projects that are, you know, high-ticket items and courses. And you know, I'm like, oh, I'll wait. You know, I'll do this after. Because after you, I'm doing Coleman Hughes, which I'm very excited about. And I've got Roz Rothstein coming and some other exciting people. And I'm like, I have to think about how I'm going to show up for each of these people differently. I don't have time for, but believe me, I still teach full time. Don't get me wrong, but it's the projects that it's like, I have one project that matters right now and the rest of these projects are going to, they just have to, they have to take a back seat. I think that one of the many things that makes me, I hate using the word sad because it's such a stupid word. It's so nondescript, but sad, is the fact that it's considered brave to stand up for Israel right now. And it should not be considered brave. It should be considered normal.
It's the fact that it's considered brave to stand up against evil, any kind of evil, is weird. It's weird. The fact that, you know, me standing up against Hamas is brave, when I stood up against Boko Haram, which is as equally ideologically, fanatically terrorist organization, was seen normal. That's the double standard.
And virtuous. And
that's the double standard of the society we live in, but also the double standard that we have internalized. I wasn't afraid to stand up and speak up against Russia when it invaded Ukraine. Sure. And I wasn't, and I'm not involved. I wasn't, when George Floyd was murdered, he was murdered. And I wasn't afraid to speak up. It wasn't brave to speak up. It was my duty to speak up. And then all these DEI deans, like the vice dean of DEI Columbia Business School and the DEI deans at Columbia and other universities. And I believe in diversity. I believe in equity. I believe in inclusion. But where are they? Like, it's incredible. I have to connect to, I realize I'm running out of battery, so I'll be walking around my apartment, which is kind of weird. We'll get us a little bit of what my apartment is.
A tour of the apartment. Okay, let me stack on that a little bit because I've been teaching yoga now for, 23 years. I discovered yoga before 9/11. So it's been basically 23 years, and I started teaching a few months after that. So it's been a long time. And the only reason I'm bringing that up is because I have seen this evolution of the world into this age of love and light, right? Like the hashtag, love and light, or sometimes light and love. But how is it, like, honestly, that in this era where DEI and tolerance and equity are such high-held standards of our community that we have gone so far to protect it? And I do want to get into specifically civil rights, but let's just throw that word out there, the civil rights of every single person, of every single group. And how is it that in that environment, that the kind of hatred and vitriol and violence and intimidation that's being thrown against the Jews, there's literally no way, and I'm not saying anything new, everybody said the same thing, that this would be tolerated for a second against any other group.
I'll tell you why.
Yeah.
I'll tell you why. It's let's put the anti-Semitism aside. And I really do believe that many, many people in the world, in the intellectual world, in the New York Times, in the art world, in universities, at Columbia Business School, and in the management division at Columbia Business School, which is my immediate division, I believe many people are anti-Semitic and they don't know it, right? We made such a big stink about implicit racism, and it's true. Like, we all have something inside from the society. They have implicit anti-Semitism. But the other thing is that they have internalized this idea of the Jew as the hyper-white.
Right?
Exactly. So the extreme right-wingers see us as fake whites, as if we're trying to be white, and that's how we're bringing down society. The left-wing, and not even the extreme left-wing,
right,
not like moderate left-wing, like the liberals in academia, I won't name names, but they all know who they are.
Right, and so do we.
And my colleagues, colleagues that are one office, two offices away from me, they know who they are. They see me as hyper-white, meaning not only am I white, but I'm really white because I'm Jewish, right? So So they see, when they see what they see. Would be said, like, I am Jewish. And if you're Jewish and you cannot walk on campus without beat you, we'll just shout at you. If you're Jewish and you can't go on campus to your class without going through people that are supporting the terrorists that want to murder you.
Right.
You know, that is a civil rights issue. Sure. That is the point. You know, they say, oh, Hamas hates Israelis. That is the most arrogant West-planning thing you could do. Hamas says they don't call us Israelis; they call us El Yahud, the Jews, right? Itbach El Yahud massacred the Jews. Itbach is massacre. The El Yahud is the Jews. So it is a civil rights issue, but because those on the left have drank from this Kool-Aid that we are some white oppressor, and right. And they don't even realize that they've drank from this Kool-Aid. You know, they will have, you know, 20 years from now, they will all be writing memoirs about how they stood up. And I am today recording who does and doesn't stand up. So 20 years from now, I can come and say, bullshit. Not only did you not stand up, right. you actually signed this letter. You actually stood in our way of standing up. When you know, everyone remembers marching at Selma with Martin Luther King in Selma. Not everyone was at Selma.
Sure.
And 20 years from now, everyone's going to remember that they stood up for Jewish civil rights. Most of them don't give a fuck.
Yes, I agree 100%. And I think it remains to be seen in 20 years if people try to distance themselves from this or not. And I hope they do. I think in the age of social media, there's a snowball effect that is dangerous. And when we're talking about 16 million Jews in the world versus whatever, 2 billion Muslims, and I'm not saying they're all anti-Jewish, of course, I'm 100% not saying that, but they're just a fraction of the world that is pushing this narrative, and I don't see social media going away. It's going to get just bigger and bigger, and I hope that we are able process.
I do feel comfortable when people say this because there are 1.5 billion Muslims in the world. I'm going to go on a limb and say that 90% of them don't even care. They don't even care. They are good people like me, like you, like everyone else. They want their kids' future to be an incredible future. They want their kids to be safe and healthy and thriving. Yeah. The 10% that do care make 150 million of very, very different extremists.
Yeah.
But it's just 10% or 15% or 5%, you know. But that is not the reason of what's happening at Columbia. At Columbia, it's led by virtuous signaling whites, virtuous signaling Midwesterners, virtuous signaling elitists who went to undergrad at an Ivy League school, got a master's in an Ivy League school, got their PhD in an Ivy League school, are teaching at an Ivy League school and feel bad about that and feel bad about them being the real oppressors because they are complicit in the trouble deal with that. They are lashing on to who they feel they can blame as white, even though we're not. We are the Jewish nation.
Yeah, I'm shy on a totally, totally unrelated subject. You're not getting great reception where you're sitting. Just so you know, it's sort of coming in and out. I don't know if there's a better place.
Is it because I'm connected to the I don't. Let's try a different place. Let's go around my house.
Yes.
My apartment.
It's time for the house tour. Okay, so why you walk? Let me say something about.
I do want to show you because, you know, people say like, wow, you're so eloquent. Wow, you know so much. It's like, I actually know nothing. This is my bedside. And these are all the books that reading since 2010. Hebrew books, English books, you know, I can give people recommendations. I try to educate myself because we're not supposed to know everything, but we are supposed to give ourselves, you know, we are supposed to be curious and not, and keep learning. So, yeah.
Please feel free to send a list of recommended reading, and I'm very happy to put it in the show notes. But one thing I do want to point out, so you're talking about, like, say, marching against Boko Haram or marching against Russia. So let's say when Ukraine came out, obviously there was a lot of outrage, and it's been 3 years now. Nobody seems to be talking about that, but they're counting, you know, how is Israel going on in this indefinite war? I mean, the war on terror in America was 20 years. Okay, let's not get into that, but it doesn't matter. When people protest a war, there was nobody walking the streets going, kill the Russians. And there was nobody walking the streets saying, don't let Russians into the library. And there was no one banging on doors saying, Russians go home. And so—
Or Russia could not exist. Death to the Russian state.
That's right. So again, like, it doesn't even— Like, there's literally, as John Spencer puts it, it's triple standards. It's not even double standards. Like, there's no standard that exists for what Jews and Israel are held to. But I also want to talk about, yes.
I do want to, I'm sorry, I keep cutting you off.
That's okay.
You know, we do talk a lot about the double standard, and the double standard is real. But I actually think there is no standard to Israel and the Jewish people. People decide on the standard based on what they want to say. If they want to blame Israel of X, they will blame it on X, and then they will post hoc create the standards. They want to blame Israel of genocide, so they will blame Israel of genocide, and then they will change the definition of genocide in order to fit reality.
That's right. Right? That's
They've been blaming Israel for genocide for 15 years. Right. If they want to blame Israel for ethnic cleansing, they will blame it for ethnic cleansing. But then they'll go back and say, well, it doesn't really fit the definition of ethnic cleansing.
Right.
Let's change the definition. And here's the crazy part that I've been seeing. Israel is the most feminist country in the Middle East. How do the feminist organizations, how do despicable intellectuals, and I say intellectuals with quote marks, like Judith Butler, deal with that? She spent her entire life fighting the good fight for feminism. How does she deal with that? She calls Israel a colonial feminist entity.
Yeah.
So you want to blame
inversion
something.
Inversion of reality.
It's not an inversion. It's a creation of reality. They decided to blame Israel for one thing, and then they'll create the reality that allows them to blame it.
Right.
That is both anti-Semitic, it's hateful, but it's also anti-intellectual. You are not that smart, Judith Butler. We see you. You know, you're supposed to be smart. If you're going to be hateful, do it in a smart way. But we see you. You're not that smart anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And this concept of Jewish civil rights, and let's delve into that because I know you have to go soon. And I want to, and you did sort of mentioned for a moment before George Floyd, and I do want to go back to that moment, not in our conversation, but that moment in time, because when the George Floyd incident happened, it really triggered the most monumental civil rights movement in the 21st century. And I mean, the whole world, including Israel, mobilized.
And because the lives of Black people matter.
The lives of everyone matters. I know it's a horrible thing to say,
course.
But it does.
But in that specific instance, when the lives of Black people are at risk, the lives of Black people matter.
That's right.
That is, you know, we can talk about the organization, BLM, and the corruption there. We can talk about the way they mobilize. We can talk about the violence. We can talk about the hatred for anti-Semitism. But the lives of Black people matter, period.
Sure.
And everybody mobilized.
And the world took, like, pivoted so hard and so fast to right that wrong. I mean, like we couldn't change the world fast enough. And the world, it changed. It changed almost overnight. And the world woke up and the world said, this isn't okay. And imagine, I mean, just imagine, had the world instead said, yeah, no, you're right. The police should kill all Black people. All Black people are criminals. Let's not let them on our campuses. Let's destroy their businesses. I mean, it never would have happened. It never would have happened. And this, it's not just the existence of anti-Semitism. We fell asleep at the wheel, but we know it's always been there. It's the normalization. It's the fact that it's not only okay, but people see it as literally hate is now virtuous, and people can't even pull the two apart. And they literally, like, they can't see the nose in front of their faces. And, you know, I mean, we as the Jewish people.
It's not about not seeing the word. It's, let me, I want to tell you the story of two Americans.
Okay.
First American, a journalist, goes to Pakistan almost 20 years ago just to cover everything as an American, to cover so American citizens know what's happening in Afghanistan in the war on terror. He gets abducted by ISIS, held by captive by ISIS, a hostage for a long time, and then they stage his execution. He faces the camera. He says, and this is what they force him to say: my father is Jewish, my mother is Jewish, I am Jewish. And then they cut off his head. And his name was Daniel Pearl.
Right.
The world didn't care. Fast forward to 2023, an American citizen, 23-year-old American citizen, born in California, goes to a music festival. Terrorists come, kill all his friends, blow off his arm, and take him into a tunnel in Gaza, where they hold him for 331 days. And then, after 331 days, they take this Jewish American, amputated kid, they line him up with five other Jewish people, and they shoot him in the head. They execute him. And that person was Hirsch Goldberg Polin. And the world doesn't care. Hirsch and Daniel are our George Floyds. The context is different. The story is different. The execution is the same. And the fact that I am sitting here in New York City and no one is marching in the streets, and I am reading the CNN accounts, and if they talk about it, they talk about it as if he was killed.
Found dead.
Or was found dead. Or he died. And my own university, Columbia University, and the new interim president, who sends amazing emails of platitudes, I am new and we will change things, could not even bring herself to say this execution of a Jewish American amputated 23-year-old is wrong. That shows you everything you need to know about everyone who's remaining silent. That tells you everything you need to know about all the universities and about all these Judith Butlers and Cynthia Nixons and Ilana Glazers. And it doesn't matter if you're Jewish or not Jewish. If you are not speaking up now against the execution of Jewish Americans, then when you were speaking up about George Floyd, it wasn't because you cared about life. It's because you cared about virtue signaling. I was speaking up about the execution of George Floyd because I value life and I abhor violence. And I'm speaking now about the execution of Hirsch Goldberg Polin because I value life and I abhor violence. And these people that choose to speak up against one or the other, it's either because you're anti-Semitic and you think that Hirsch had it coming, or that you have dehumanized Jews so much that you don't care. So I don't know if someone sees this and realizes this about themselves, or if someone else can share it with their friend, but the world needs to understand the life of every Jew matters. And until we see people in the streets shouting that the life of every Jew matters, we're going to have infringement on Jewish civil rights for eternity.
Yes, and during the post George Floyd era, whatever you want to call it, we were being excoriated. The worst thing you could possibly say was, of course, his life matters, all life matters. And they're like, no, no, Black Lives Matter. And I get it. I get it. So it was the moment. And
it was the moment. You don't want to defocus it from them.
That's right. But what I want to say is there is nobody outside of the Jewish world, and including many inside of the Jewish world, who are saying we need to stop anti-Semitism. Oh, and by the way, Islamophobia and all sorts of hate. That very same thing that people were being attacked for saying all life matters, now nobody, I mean, literally, even a lot of our Jewish leadership is afraid to speak up against anti-Semitism without, you know, saying, and
yeah,
Islamophobia.
Because they don't allow it. That's how they silence us. The vice dean of DEI at Columbia announced an event because they are so caring and so fucking involved with themselves. He announced an event about anti-Semitism, Islamophobia, and anti-Arab prejudice. And I emailed back and I said, all of those things are important. By you lumping them together, and he, by the way, is a Jew that married a Christian woman, raises his kids as Christian, and I'm not okay with that. I don't care. But I want to give you a little bit of what they love to call context. By you lumping anti-Semitism that you don't experience because you're hiding your Jewishness, Islamophobia that you don't experience because you're not Muslim, and anti-Arab prejudice that you don't experience because you're not Arab, you are basically saying none of these things deserve and merit consideration on their own.
Right.
So he gives me this flip-flop answer on email. I have everything recorded. And by the way, his name is Adam Galinsky, Vice Dean of DEI at Columbia Business School. And I got everything recorded. And he says, you know, Islamophobia and anti-Semitism, they are highly correlated. He goes this scientific. They're highly correlated. They go very much with each other. And I said, you want to go there? Let's go there. Anti-Semitism existed for 1,000 years before Islam was ever created, because Islam was created in the year 600, around 600. And anti-Semitism, the first instances are about 400 BC. So no, they're not highly correlated. Two, anti-Semitism comes from the extreme left and from the extreme right. Yes, the extreme right hates Muslims just as it hates the Jews, but the extreme left hates Jews, but does not hate Muslims. Three, I don't remember seeing many Muslims walked into the gas chambers in Auschwitz. I actually remember Hitler meeting with the Grand Mufti. That doesn't mean that Hitler loved Muslims. I'm sure he was an Islamophobe as well in his own heart. But you cannot say that anti-Semitism and Islamophobia are two of the same thing. If you care about this, have a session for 2 hours about anti-Semitism, and I will be there. And then have another session for 2 hours about Islamophobia, and I will also be there to show my support and to educate myself. But if you bundle them together, you show that you, Columbia Business School, you, the Vice Dean of DEI, and you, the person, Adam Galinsky, does not care.
Well, there's also a certain element of gaslighting to I'm not saying that Islamophobia doesn't exist, but you'd have to live under a rock to say that the level of anti-Semitism on campus is in any way parallel to anything that is happening to Arabs on campus. There is no equivalent. Yeah.
But look, I agree. The statistics agree with you. New York City, number one hate crime for 8 years in a row is anti-Jew hate crime. More than any race, sex, gender orientation, anything. Anti-Jew hate crimes is the number one. I agree. At the same time, I refuse to get into this oppression Olympics of who has it worse. I don't care. If you are afraid,
I agree, but there's a time and a place for everything.
No, I disagree.
I mean, like during George Floyd, it wouldn't have been appropriate to be like, and anti-Semitism. Let's have Black and anti-Semitism in the same, like it was
no,
issue.
True,
at
true
the
but at the same time, if today, when anti-Semitism is the biggest civil rights issue right now in September 2024 in New York City.
Sure.
Right? But even though that's the biggest, most important civil rights issue right now, just based on the statistics, right?
Sure.
Still, if you have fear walking around with a hijab anywhere in the city, then I'm with you and I stand with you, because that's unacceptable.
100%.
And if you have a fear of the police because you are African American or a person of color, or you just have dark skin, like many, many Jews do, then I am with you. And if you are gay or lesbian or trans or bi, if I or queer, I am with you, because it's a civil rights issue. But now is the time to also rise for Jewish civil rights, and you should rise with me.
That's right. That's right. And in I have to say, so the sort of pan-Jewish catchphrase of Tikkun Olam, which is healing the world, that's pretty much, it's such a deeply ingrained Jewish value, and it's what we are brought up on. And we have always stood a march for all civil rights, right? It again, like what I'm saying is not to be construed to say that I don't believe in standing up for every single person. I 100% do, and it's a very Jewish value. Right? We march with MLK. We march in the Women's March. We march for LGBTQ rights. I mean, it's the only place in the Middle East, Israel, where you can actually live freely and be gay. I mean, Tel Aviv is like West Hollywood.
And I'll tell you more than that. When the Israeli government tries to constrict the rights of the LGBTQ community, look at how many people show up in the street and say no.
That's right.
Gay men should be able to adopt. It doesn't matter if they're gay.
That's right.
If they are dedicated to their children, then they should be. So,
So
we're everywhere and we fight for everything.
Right. Yes, the Jewish values. I mean, we helped like to found the NAACP, and the ACLU is almost all Jews. And the ADL has a whole department that is literally dedicated to fighting Islamophobia.
Yeah.
You can send that in the list of books.
It's a great book. It's the good fight. It's the ADL.
Yeah.
It's about all the issues that the ADL has been fighting for. Not just about, it's not just about Jews. It's about civil rights. It's about economic rights. Unfortunately, we Jews have focused so much on everything else, but we have forgotten to pay attention to our fight. But that's why I keep telling people, today is day one. Today we start fighting for Jewish civil rights.
Yes, and I think that the fighting for others has gone so far, right, that we wind up with organizations like Jewish Voice for Peace, or If Not Now, where you have Jewish people literally fighting against the Jewish state, literally defending Hamas, because they've gone so far into defending the other. And
well, that's actually, I have a different take on them. Can I share it with you?
Can I share you my thought really quickly?
Yeah.
It comes from intergenerational trauma of fearing that if I am the Jew, then I am at risk. And whether it's nascent or, you know, right there at the forefront of their mind, I think it's, if I show that I am so open-minded, no one's going to attack me for being a Jew.
I have a slightly different take. I agree with you on that, but I have a slightly different take. I don't think it's trauma. I think, actually, if you look at the Jewish people's history, right, you see that what Herschel said, that branches will wither and die, but the trunk remains strong. You see that throughout Jewish history, we've had sects. We had sects on the extreme left and sects on the extreme right. What do I mean? We've had very, very closed-minded sects that were so fundamentalist that they couldn't even sustain themselves. They withered and died, right? That's the sect that gave us the Purushim. They gave us the Dead Sea Scrolls. They disappeared from the world. Then we had sects that were so open-minded, that would, like the Hellenistic Jews, that were so open and to like bring in, you know, a Greek priest into the dvir, to the chalai chalim, the to be the priest in the temple, and they too also withered and died. Not they didn't die out of starvation or famine. They disappeared into the Hellenistic world. We've had it throughout the centuries. We had people that convert. They were, you know, thought this is the way to go, and they disappeared. We had the people that are like that. Now we have two exact same sects in modern Jewish times. The fundamentalist extremists are the Neturei Karta. They are so extremist, so isolationist, so fundamentalist that they will wither and die. And on the other side, we have an anti-Zionist sect that are so open-minded, so want to be accepted by the Hellenistic world, which is now academia, which is now, you know, the Western intelligentsia or something, mm-hmm. that they will also wither and die. Because when you and me, Shana, we speak, I am Jewish and you're Jewish. We're Jewish people, but we're also part of the Jewish people.
Yes.
But when two JVP, Jewish Voices for Peace yeah. people speak, they are both Jewish, they are both Jewish people, but they have removed themselves from the Jewish people. They've removed themselves from the symbols, they've removed right. themselves from the history, and they've removed themselves right. from the language. So right. we should treat them as a sect. And that's it. They are a sect, and like every sect, they will wither and die. The problem is how much havoc they will create on the Jewish people until they do so.
Yeah. Shai, I think we have 3 minutes left. How's your...
I've been ranting. So let's do five, six more. Yeah.
I don't even know where to begin. I have so many things I want to talk to you about still.
We can do this again.
Okay. We'll that would be again. Great.
I can't promise you like next week or, you know, because my schedule is insane.
Okay.
But I promise that we can do this again.
Okay, because I want to talk about stuff like your Title VI. I want to get into like some of the nitty-gritty, but let me throw in a word that hasn't really been mentioned yet. And let's use the word not just hyper-white, not just oppressor, but privilege. And we as the Jewish people have been labeled as the most privileged of classes by the voices of campus protesters. Which is pretty ironic, given our long and horrifically storied history of violent persecution. Like, people can try to deny it, but it's undeniable. We have worked as a people so tirelessly through the generations to rise as high as we have, but we came from the ashes. I mean, literally.
Yeah.
Literally.
Well, from
the ashes. How is it that we have come to be labeled as privileged? This word that people throw around is so harmful, not just to Jews, to white people. I hate that word because,
yeah.
and I know you said that that's why you wear a star, is because someone tried to call you white in your life.
Someone did.
So how do we become this privileged class?
So privilege I will tell you.
Isn't what got us to where we are.
So here's the problem of the word privilege.
Yeah.
We use the word privileged as an identity. Not we, I don't. But the DEI mantra that has taken over universities. And by the way, I brought into the Kool-Aid for a while. I did. No longer. But they use the word privilege as an identity, as a static marker, right. rather than what they should, which is having a privilege. We all have a privilege. We all, you know, and we all have things that hold us back. Middle class people of color have a lot of things that are holding them back because of their race, their skin, whatever, but also a lot of privilege by being middle class in the richest country in the world. Poor white working poor Americans have a privilege of appearing, of being white, of being safe with police interactions or safer in police interaction, but they also face a lot of disadvantages of their socioeconomic, of educational, of infrastructure, stuff like that. We all have a privilege and we all have the problems. So when we start marking people as privileged, it's like that's a stamp that you receive.
Right.
But and here's how things changed dramatically. My grandmother was raised in abject poverty in Jerusalem. She lived through the siege on Jerusalem. They were so poor that her parents could only send one kid to high school. And because my grandmother was the smart one, she got sent to high school, where her older sister had to go work when she finished eighth grade.
Right.
My grandfather, he was the son of a salt miner and grew up in a one bedroom, a zero bedroom house in Atlit, right outside the displaced people's camp. His father would drive to the Dead Sea, come back every month, you know, exhausted. My grandfather ended up doing very well for himself, became the vice president of El Al. My grandmother became the principal. That's a whole other story. My grandfather was instrumental in bringing Eichmann to court in Israel. My grandmother became a principal of a school. Then my father did extremely financially well for himself. My parents are extreme. They're affluent. They're extreme philanthropists in Israel, mostly for hospitals. And then I come. I pass as white, I'm heterosexual, I'm a male, and I come from a very well-off family. I do have financial concerns, but they're not that big, they're not that important. I have a lot of privilege. But if you come and say you're privileged, you're basically saying you have no ability to not have privilege. Because when I walk in the streets with the Star of David, that is a hindrance. People look at me differently. People shout things at me. People turn their backs at me. Sure. When I speak for Jewish civil rights, my colleagues turn the other cheek.
Right.
And but then also turn their back.
And it's funny because that's literally like the next thing that popped into my mind is it's like, if we assume for argument's sake that you are the typical Jew, okay, you're white, you're wealthy, you're educated, you're successful, you're, you know, all the things. So let's just for argument's sake say, okay, yes, we're a privileged class. And by the way, forget about the 50% of us that happen to be people of color. Let's forget about those. We're white. Okay.
Forget about the 20% of Jews living in Israel under the poverty line, which is horrible and shouldn't happen. There are homeless Jews in Israel. Like, are they privileged? Like,
Of course. So let's, but I'm just playing devil's advocate here. Okay. So let's just assume the greater Jewish population in the Western world, meaning Europe and America, are in fact privileged or maybe, we'll just say more specifically, we hit above our weight class. Okay.
Yeah.
We'll just say that. Yeah, so the question is that I think where the wall gets hit is a so-called like privileged class still entitled or even more so in need of civil rights? If we have money, if we have influence, like so I know we have a couple minutes left. Just talk to me very specifically, Jewish civil rights. We are successful beyond our numbers. There's no question about that. So where's the confluence?
As long as the Jewish people have to have armed guards in order to congregate, in order to pray, in order to celebrate their moments of joy, like their bar mitzvahs and their weddings, in order to send their kids to Jewish schools, in order to grieve in public about to Jewish people, as long as Jewish people cannot feel safe to be individually Jewish and as a collective Jewish, publicly Jewish in the cities of New York and LA and San Diego and everywhere in the country and everywhere in the world, then we do not have equal treatment in the world. And this is our fight for Jewish civil rights. Period.
Amen. Okay. Before we go, what is your tikva? What's your hope? Where is the hope?
My children and other children. I came back from Montreal. I'm getting emotional. I spoke with the
incredible 10th graders and 11th graders at Herzliya Private Jewish School, the school has been around for 130 years, and they give me so much hope. I spoke with a community organizer named Karin Toledano, who has been doing March for Bring Them Home, and her twin kids, that I think are 11 or 10, show up with everything. The boy wears his yarmulke. They have her Star of David, and they give me hope. I showed up with McGill and Concordia and met the students, Anastasia and Michael at Concordia, and Amanda and Drew also at Concordia, Amanda, all the other students at McGill that are organizing, and they've created this organization called Startup Nation, and they give me hope. Like, seeing the fact that this isn't just me, this isn't that we're all fighting, and we're all, you know, when I say, and I keep saying this, this is, every day is day one. Every day we need to bring out the energy as if this is day one until we no longer need to fight. We can't, you know, we keep counting up the days for the hostages, and it's unbelievable we have to. But when it comes to Jewish civil rights, every day is day one. Today is day one, and that's what gives me hope.
Amen. Can I go ahead and steal something from the ending of your show and ask you if you have one either Jewish or pro-Israel organization that you would like to encourage people to donate to today on day one?
There's so many. And people have said so many incredible people doing incredible things. I want to say two. One, I'm blanking on its name. Shoot. I think it's called Brothers Forever. I may be wrong. Michelle Achdut mentions it in the podcast episode I had with her in the Here I Am with Shai Davidai at the end. It's a charity in Israel of wounded soldiers helping wounded soldiers. And I've met some people that were treated by them and then came and are volunteering. And they show up on the moment you show up with the helicopter, the army helicopter in the hospital, they're already waiting for you. They're there to help you with your treatment, with your mental well-being, with money for treatment, with connections, with school, with your job, everything. So that's one. And the other thing, because we're at the brink of starting a real social movement, I urge everyone to, A, give money, and two, join End Jew Hatred. They do amazing digital activism, but they also do amazing rallies and protests and mobilizing people. And I really believe that if we all come together under one umbrella, without taking away from the other things that we do, but also under this umbrella, under this tent, we can really, really exact change here.
I love that. If you could send me a link to that first organization, obviously I know End Jew Hatred. Wow, I was at their rally last night, in fact. And if I could just add to that, Israel Bonds is a great way to support the state of Israel. And the beauty of Israel Bonds is if you don't have money to donate, it's actually just an investment. You get it back, and you get it back with interest.
And you know, another thing is, you know, another way to get back with interest, support these people that are working hard, social influencers and activists that are working hard and doing things on their own dime. My friend Eitan Chitayev has been sending so much money and of his own and sleeping 4 hours a night since October 23. I don't know her, but Roots Metal does amazing work informing people on social media.
Sure.
Yehudim Omrim is another one. Like, people that are doing things, and you can help them. Just $5 can help them, and it comes back with interest.
It's impossible to list them all. Ilan Levy, of course, with the Israeli Citizens Brigade, which he started as a nonprofit, and also TPS, the Israeli Press Service, who's the only organization out there that's giving the unbiased truth about Israel, is also a nonprofit. Yeah. And anyway, this conversation can
More. Shana, I promise you, you drop me an email right after this, and we'll talk. We'll speak more, because I also want to get to know you more.
Okay. Well, maybe I'll come to New York and be there with Shai Davidai.
Come to my podcast, and I'll be able to say, here I am with Shana Meyerson.
I would love that. Shai, thank you so much for being so generous not just with your time with us today, but honestly, like it or not, you are changing the world. Yeah.
I hope so.
Just like it.
Thank you.
You are so much. Your humility precedes you.
And Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Okay. All right. Bye-bye.